more than 4,000 graduate students in over 80 different programs of study.
You guys are sort of all over the world, it seems like.
It's kind of mind-blowing when you think about it.
Here on Inspiration Dissemination.
Photographs of this data set stretching over a much longer period of time.
They're now converted into basically mathematical shapes, and we can now analyze the statistics of this shape.
Good evening, listeners.
Good evening, listeners.
Good evening, listeners. It's April 7th, and you're tuned into 88.7 KBVR Corvallis. It is currently just after 7 p.m., and on a Sunday, that can mean only one thing. It's time for another episode of Inspiration Dissemination. I'm Lillian Paget-Cobb.
And I'm Kristen Finch. At Oregon State, we have more than 4,000 graduate students in over 80 different programs of study. And here on Inspiration Dissemination, we feature the research and personal stories of one of these students each week, or in this case, a postdoc. Yeah. So if you're a graduate student at OSU and you're interested in coming on the show, or you just want to find out more about the awesome things happening at Oregon State University, you can check out our blog at blogs.oregonstate.edu/inspiration, where you can read more about our up-and-coming guests and find the links to our Twitter and Facebook pages.
Inspiration Dissemination is recorded live, and any opinions expressed on the show are those of the hosts and their guests and do not necessarily represent Oregon State University or this station. Tonight, we are joined by Delia Shelton from the Department of Environmental and Molecular Toxicology. Delia is a National Science Foundation postdoctoral fellow carrying out research in the lab of Robert Tanguay. She uses zebrafish to study animal behavior in groups. And specifically, she is looking at the effect of heavy metal cadmium on animal behavior. Hi, Delia.
Hi.
Thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Can you tell us more about the research you've been doing as a postdoctoral fellow here at OSU?
Yes. So I study, I guess, social complexity or understanding how and why animals form groups. And rather than understanding that from a molecular point of view, I take a look at how whole organisms interact and create these different types of dynamics. You might think of flocks of birds or schools of fish or swarms of bees that make these different movement patterns. And so to do that, I use zebrafish. And zebrafish are this kind of biomedical miracle, in a sense. There's a lot of hope in the zebrafish because it has the ability to regenerate its heart, even at larval stages, its parts of its brain. And its quick ability to adapt to laboratory life has allowed them to be a fan favorite for biomedical researchers. If they've sequenced the genome, finding that 74% of their genome is related to or is analogous to the humans, it's allowed them to look at different types of gene therapies. And we know a lot about their neuroarchitecture as well. But here, for my research, rather than, again, looking at these kind of reductionistic techniques, I harness that biomedical toolkit and then also look at how whole organisms, whole zebrafish interact to form these groups in both the wild in India and also in the laboratory here. And I ask questions about how do you become a leader? So do you need to be bigger than everybody else? Do you have to have some type of information? If you're female, do you have to be more aggressive to have this inordinately large effect on the group? And then once identifying the key characteristics that are related to these different social roles, I then ask, can we actually engineer them using this biomedical toolkit that I have to create groups that are successful or resilient against anthropogenic change?
Oh, very cool. So like a zebrafish, maybe a little bit of a proxy organism for humans or other vertebrates?
Yes. So zebrafish are the leading or one of the leading biomedical models for the National Institutes of Health. And they are found in over 9,000 labs currently, and they're increasing. In fact, the Mecca for zebrafish laboratory research started right down the road at Eugene back in the 80s. And so, yeah, they're just exponentially increasing. Again, I said there's a lot of hope riding on this little fish.
Right. So, and you found out some stuff about zebrafish through your research in the lab and in India. And so now you want to kind of maybe expose your zebrafish in the lab to the same types of things or find out ways to affect zebrafish behavior and draw conclusions from that?
So I've done quite a bit with zebrafish in both in the lab and the field. Again, I can tell you a little bit about my field research. There we're looking at more of a population level study where we've gone to several different sites throughout India. So zebrafish, I should back up a little bit and tell you about where zebrafish are from. They're not from the lab in Eugene down there. Most people think, but you can find them in aquariums, and they're really great starter fish because they're super resilient, right? They can do all these regenerations, have all these regenerative abilities, and yeah, it's hard for kids to kill them. So great first pet. So they're actually native to South Asia. So you can find them in Pakistan, India, Myanmar, and Bangladesh. And so a particular green spot for zebrafish is in India. And so that's where I've gone a couple times now. And my first expedition as a postdoc involved going to about four or five different sites we actually found fish. We went to a lot more.
Right.
Yeah. So, and to some sites, it required like a 17-hour train ride followed by another 2-hour car ride to go and collect the fish. But the question that we were asking was to look at how environmental variation, so looking at particularly these anthropogenic factors such as water flow these environmental factors that are subject to anthropogenic change such as water flow or vegetation loss would affect or is related to aspects of these collective behavior in these zebrafish. And again, this collective behavior is where you're seeing these animals move in groups as though they're in turning in unison, as though they're single organisms, much like you would see with starling flocks or schools of fish. And so we examined how these different environmental features were related to them. And related to these aspects of like leadership, movement, collective movement, fission and fusion, and group size. And we found that the groups, their aspects of collective behavior were related to water flow. So again, with faster flowing water, you found larger groups, you found the groups were more volatile, so they fissioned and fused a lot, meaning coming together and breaking apart. And they had also more frequent changes in leadership than those in still water. And we also saw lots of variation in the pollutants there. And so watching them being so close to humans and these human settlements, and watching people there not really care about zebrafish, it kind of struck me that, these zebrafish are a billion, probably multi-billion, at least billion-dollar industry in worldwide, and these people from the developing countries aren't benefiting from them in the profound ways that others in developed countries are. So I was thinking maybe they could be sentinels for contaminant exposures and seeing how these contaminants, particularly cadmium, could affect their behavior. So, yeah.
So cadmium, where does that really come from in the environment?
Yeah.
It occurs naturally, but then it also is increasing in its sort of presence in the environment.
Yeah, so cadmium, everybody today has probably touched a little bit of cadmium. So it's found widely in foods such as grains, foods, particularly heavy in leafy greens like spinach. You've also, if you have a love for chocolate like I do, you've probably kissed it when you've eaten a Hershey's Kisses or other types of chocolate. And so it's accumulating in the environment because it's found in your cell phone, in your batteries in particular, and also other batteries. So as people discard these wastes because there's rather than recycling or them or putting them at locations for a safe drop off, as they rust or decompose, the cadmium gets absorbed in the waterways and then it ends up in the soil and the plants absorb it. And cadmium has a 2+ charge, meaning that it can when absorbed in the body, it has the ability to displace other trace metals such as calcium, zinc, and magnesium. And calcium, in particular, is used a lot in neural functioning and muscle movement. And so when cadmium binds there, it can negatively affect those processes. And cadmium has a particularly long half-life that can reach decades. And so once you have cadmium, you're stuck with it. And people who have elevated cadmium levels have reported to have sensory deficits, meaning that they have impairments in their vision, they can't see as well, and it's related to age-related macular degeneration. They can't smell as well, and they also have reported hearing loss. And this is not only susceptible for people who work with cadmium, but also people have been exposed, such as those through dietary exposure, eating shellfish or these other foods.
And how does cadmium potentially affect a zebrafish or anyone else?
Yeah, so what we've seen, bringing these zebrafish and using them kind of as to examine how cadmium might affect behavior, what we've done in the lab is we've exposed a fraction of the zebrafish to this cadmium, and we find that it then allows them to have an inordinately large effect on the group. So groups with just a fraction of the fish exposed to the cadmium, not even half, about a third of the fish, it changes how the group uses landmarks. It changes their boldness, meaning their propensity to approach novel objects, and also makes the group far more aggressive without leading to other effects on the other aspects of social behavior. So we didn't see that cadmium altered the closeness of these individuals in the group. So the zebrafish, these unaffected zebrafish, are still keeping these cadmium-impaired individuals in the shoal, which you might then see that it has consequences for predation pressure or predation. So if you have these sick cadmium-exposed individuals in the group and that are approaching these kind of novel, you might think, new food items or predators, meaning that they're more bold, it's leading the other groups, making them more susceptible to this predation pressure. So, yeah, it could definitely have these negative effects on the group. But
so you studied zebrafish when you went to India, and did you bring any of those zebrafish back with you to the lab, or do you use separate populations, sort of this lab-adapted zebrafish here in the lab setting, and study that? Do they sort of exist independently?
Yeah. So one of the goals of my postdoc was to bring them back in the lab from India. That didn't quite happen, even though we went through a lot of effort. Again, I told you one of these sites required a 17-hour train ride, then another 2-hour car ride, and then collecting them and then bringing them back on that whole entire journey. But again, the local people don't really value them. They'll just kind of, if they're catching them, they're looking more things like for chana or snakehead, which is the predator, the zebrafish. And in fact, to the dismay of the the other postdoc that I was working with at the time, she was trying to collect them off the bank and throw them back into the water, and because the local people were just throwing them on the bank. They don't really care. So, again, it's really this really heightened Western biomedical research that cares about these zebrafish.
Yeah, and so, but the local people are not super interested in them, or they're kind of just like a catch and release, or like catch by accident type of thing. But then your zebrafish, when you're coming back from India, disappeared somehow?
Yeah, they disappeared. Yeah. So, someone who I was working with, mysteriously, they lost them along the way.
Right.
So we actually got them, we did a handoff at one of the field sites to get them to the exporter, and they kind of didn't make it. And so I spent another month there collecting zebrafish. I tried to work with additional exporters, again, trying to find a really great collaborator there. And I waited about, after that month, I came back to the States, and we still have not gotten our zebrafish. There's been, I guess, issues with the permits. Issues with the permits and other things. In fact, we thought at one point that they were going to come, and we were ready to go, and the exporter says, they're not here. So even after all this time preparing here in the lab, getting everything ready, the zebrafish have not made it here. So, yeah.
So someone in India finds them particularly attractive, I guess.
Yes.
Besides you and your other postdoc friend.
Yes, definitely.
But I heard you say that one of your goals of your postdoc is to build a collaboration with someone in India for these types of projects, and then also, you know, hopefully get zebrafish back from India. But what were some of your other goals for your postdoc?
Yeah, so some of my other goals were to, expand the type of funding sources that I could become attractive to. So I've been predominantly funded by the National Science Foundation, as I'm on a National Science Foundation postdoc, and also my labs were funded that way. But to expand to the national, to NIH, or so National Institutes of Health, and with that tie, that's really kind of solidified my desire to understand more about cadmium, so I can then apply for funding through the National Institutes for Environmental Health and Safety. And then also to learn about how institutes work. So I strategically selected postdocs that were at institutes. One was at the Leibniz Institute in Berlin. Another one was I started out initially at the Oregon Hatchery Research Center, which is also another type of institute here in Oregon, to understand how they work, because I hope to run one day. And then the other one was to find someone. In that time, I was really gung-ho about going into academia, so I wanted to find an advisor that I got along well with, who published and had a history of getting students into academia. So, yeah, those were my kind of four goals. Yeah.
So you are sort of splitting your time, your postdoctoral research time, at three different institutions, and how has that sort of impacted your experience?
So I'm doing a tri-institute postdoc, and I would say NSF is wonderful and unique in that I'm actually considered an independent contractor. So by the government and at different institutions, a visiting research scholar. So that puts me in an interesting position where I do have academic advisors, but they don't really direct my time as much. Again, they are supportive and supporting my research, as the fellowship only provides salary but not a lot of resources for conducting the research. So yeah, it's been a great experience. I've learned a lot about how the German system works, and it's very different from the American system in terms of academic training and also research. When I was in Berlin, the place was more, I found out when I was there, that the priest has limited space in terms of doing experimental research. It's more of like this amazing think tank where you have these really brilliant scientists from all over the world kind of meet there, and they discuss kind of what are the next big questions in science. And then they all kind of scurry out to different parts of the world. Me, I went to India, and they come back and do their research there, and then come back and maybe write a review paper together about what they found. And then they publish separately their individual empirical studies. So that was very different. So I needed to find a place where I could do my empirical research. And so I landed here at the Tangaway Lab. It's probably one of the most spectacular labs for behavior research that I've seen, even though they are very much invested in toxicology screening. But the number of setups that they have to rapidly behaviorally assess individual zebrafish at multiple life stages is something I have yet to see in all the labs that I've been in across the world. So it's really a great place to work. So.
How did you go about selecting the labs that you wanted to do research in? Because you must have been sort of assessing that when you were in your PhD or finishing up. So how did you navigate that and balance that?
Yeah, so during my about a year before I defended my PhD, probably a year and a half before I defended. So in May of 2000, so I defended in 2016. So in May 2015, I knew I wanted to write a National Science Foundation postdoc because I wanted the autonomy to pursue my own ideas. And I didn't want to be restricted by geographic boundaries as well. And so during that time, I searched the internet for publicly available funding proposals. And I was happy to find them on We Ecology and Figshare and other spaces. So I collected them and I emailed those people. And I asked them for their proposals, and I also asked them for advice. And one person gave me fantastic advice, and he says, go and try and meet those postdoctoral fellows, your potential advisors, and decide who you want to work with. And he set out this really nice timeline. So he said, by August, you need to have started working on your proposal. So I solidified my postdoc advisors during the summer, and I can tell you a little bit about how I did that. And then I started writing again in August and probably had a draft to my reviewers, meaning people in my lab, and also my potential my postdoc advisors, so that they could review it by October, mid-October. Again, the deadline is in November. So this allowed me to get revisions and feedback on those. And so how I selected these advisors, I was really fortunate to be funded by an NSF IGERT, which allowed me to go and visit different places. I also received the advice from this previous NSF fellow who said, invite yourself to go to seminars. And so I did. I invited myself to seminars at places where I wanted to do, places that I was considering doing a fellowship. And they integrated me in their seminar cycle, and this allowed me to visit those universities in Canada, Scotland, and did I go anywhere? Yeah, other places in the U.S. for free, essentially.
Right. So becoming a seminar speaker, that was your way of securing funding for kind of this exploration of these potential places to work.
Yes, exactly. Yeah,
that's a very smart thing that I'm going to have to remember.
Yeah.
Seems like a very creative approach.
Yeah. It works. In fact, I think now there are a lot of listservs where you can add yourself. But I would be more proactive than that. I would definitely email someone you're considering to and proactively say, hey, can I come and give a talk?
Yeah. Very cool.
Is there anything you think is particularly important for graduate students to keep in mind? Is there kind of contemplating their next move or looking at a postdoc?
Yeah, so I would suggest that what they would do, I know people are probably really looking for a postdoc, but I wouldn't stress out over it. I would say if you're considering, it's okay to consider alternative careers. And in fact, I would strongly suggest it because 0.5% of people actually wind up in academia. And for industry jobs, you do not need a postdoc. In fact, you probably don't need to know how to write a grant or publish. So I would definitely suggest to explore other options. I would try and if you maybe do a postdoc in industry if you can. I would, don't be afraid to change career paths. So I would definitely suggest those things.
Yeah. Another thing that you have pursued during your postdoc was commercialization opportunities. And can you tell us a little bit about what that consisted of? It sounds like you developed an assay.
Yeah. So I know probably like me and many PhDs, you spend a lot of time tinkering in the lab and inventing lots of really cool things. So a lot of funding agencies, NSF, NIH, and the Department of Defense, the DOD, have these pockets of funding to help you develop those ideas and see if there's actually a commercial market for them. And so that that novel duct taped together kind of assay or apparatus that you've developed might be bigger than something that's just going to go into your dissertation or into a single publication. And that is the case, or that's something that I'm exploring. So I created an assay that VisioGlow that assesses multiple aspects of functional vision in all seeing animals. And I disclosed this invention to the OSU. And then I also, while checking my email, I got a note from NSF saying, hey, do you have an idea that you might think that has commercial potential? Explore it. And so I listened in and I learned about this really awesome opportunity. So it's the National Science Foundation Innovation Corps. And it allows academics to learn to think like entrepreneurs. And so if you have an idea, you can you don't even have to have a technology. That's how easy it is. You just have to have an idea. It can be, and you don't have to have a proof of concept. I was lucky that I did, and it's evolving. But and you can apply as a graduate student or a postdoc. You don't have to be a full faculty to apply. And the grant is quite small, meaning in length. So it's only a 2-page grant, and it's really based on your team. So you need an entrepreneurial lead, a technical lead, and an industry mentor. And if you partner with the OSU Accelerator, there's Carl Mundorf there, and he can gladly link you up with an industry mentor to kind of pursue this opportunity. And so within a month, you can know whether or not you're funded or not. And so it's a fantastic opportunity to maybe take something that you've developed into the lab to the next level.
So maybe get a patent. Is that what you were aiming for with this grant?
You don't actually need to get a patent. So this grant is actually for customer discovery. So just, again, it's even though I'm more in the hard scientist, it's taking you to a social scientist to aspect. So I've partnered with Molly Arnold here. And so to kind of enhance my soft skills to ask people what are the needs and challenges that they're facing in industry, so and to see if my technology actually fits those needs. And so, yeah, you can get a patent. That's one option, but you can also have a trade secret, like Coca-Cola. Coca-Cola is not patented. There's probably other options as well. So this grant allows you to explore that, one, to see if there's potential market. And then once if you see that there is, then you can explore patenting or some of these other options. Then the best thing is if you have a buyer. But if you don't, you might need some more research and development, and NSF or NIH can supply you with a small business innovation research grant, which you can then apply for. So there's these kind of stepping stones, but the first one is particularly easy, and I recommend, even if you're an undergraduate, you could apply for this.
Yeah, so. Just seeing if, I guess it to me, it sounds like from your description, just kind of seeing if there is interest from a broader audience, from your industry, in your particular idea, which may actually be like an assay in your case, or it may just be an idea for something that needs further development.
Right. Yeah. So, it can be a particular machine learning script that could be applied to, I don't know, human health or something. So yeah, again, it's just flying. Is there a need for this? Yes. Does your technology meet this need? If it doesn't, can you tweak it so that it does? Or maybe you can't. So just exploring that. Okay. So and capitalizing on kind of this federal money that has been invested in your science to take it to another level outside of academia.
Yeah. Very cool.
That's great to know about. Yeah. So looking forward, you're finishing up your postdoc now?
Yeah, so I am finishing up. And I was lucky enough during my first year as a postdoc, actually, I was offered a job. And they wanted me to leave my postdoc immediately and start. But I was like, you know, this NSF postdoc is pretty sweet, you know, uninterrupted research time, no teaching, and all these other benefits to kind of really explore this research and gain new skills.
And potentially be a better professor after that, or a better academic.
Yes, yes. And so I, again, made those arguments to this university. Hey, I'll be a more I'll be a better professor, I'll bring more resources to this university if I can do this postdoc. And I said okay after some negotiation time. And I'll be starting at the University of Tennessee in Knoxville in the psychology department, and I'll be opening up my lab. EPIC is the Environmental Psychology Innovation Center, and I'm actively recruiting graduate students and postdocs and other talented people to join me there. So,
yeah. So you heard it here first, folks, on Inspiration Dissemination. Delia is starting a lab very soon. That's so exciting. That's EPIC.
Yes, thank you. I'm excited.
All right. And we're getting around to the end of our time talking to Delia on Inspiration Dissemination, but we still have our two traditions to wrap up. So we still need to ask you for your advice. And what is your advice? And then who would be most helped by your advice?
Yeah, so I would say my advice would be to maybe take a different path. And look at some of the things that you've already developed and see where your skills apply. Again, this is, even though I'm going in academia, this is speaking to, I guess, those graduate students in the lab or even postdocs who are maybe considering academia or not sure where they want to go. But I would definitely see about maybe those courses or those skills that they've picked up that are maybe relatable to other industries. Maybe you could create a startup from a technology you've developed, or maybe what you've learned would allow you to get an industry job in pharma or even in the tech industry. And I would definitely say explore those skills, because even if you are going to go into academia, again, if you're going to be able to adequately mentor your students so that they can then have jobs, you're also going to need to know where those skill sets lie and where you can push them so that they can have job security or somewhere else. So yeah. I say look at your skill sets, and then don't be afraid to apply them to other areas.
Look broadly for your next step, perhaps. Yeah. Very cool. And then our final one is to ask you to provide a song for us to as your outro. And so the question there is, what song have you picked and what does this song mean to you?
Yeah, so I picked from an Afro-Cubana from Celia Cruz. She's an Afro-Cubana, and she's a beautiful singer from Cuba. And she has this just kind of this electric music that has really gotten me through all those ups and downs of graduate school. And I love to salsa dance in my free time. So it's La Vida es una Carnaval. So life is a carnival. And it is. And yeah.
Very cool. Right.
Thank you so much for coming on our show.
Yeah, great. Yeah. And we'll be on the lookout for hearing more about how cadmium or other pollutants are affecting not just zebrafish, but potentially other vertebrates, and then wanting to see the excitement that's coming out of your lab soon when you get to the next step.
Yes, thank you for having me on the show. I appreciate it. It's been fun.
All right, and here is La Vida es un Carnaval by Celia Cruz. You heard it on Inspiration Dissemination.